Jeff Katz has joined us on Sports Byline. We're talking about his book, Split Season 1981. Subtitle on this, and I mentioned it before the break, The Strike That Saved Baseball. Explain.
So ownership in 1981 was really looking to go backwards in time. Backwards in time meaning when they had more control, if not full control. One of the things we're all fed, I'm an East Coast kid, I was born in Brooklyn and raised in Long Island. One of the things we're always told is that the golden era of baseball was from the late 40s to the early 60s. But when you really think about it, it was only true if you were a fan of the New York Yankees, the New York Giants, or the Brooklyn Dodgers. If you were a fan in St. Louis or Boston or Philadelphia, that was a lousy time to be a baseball fan because your team had no chance to improve themselves by acquiring players. In the early years of free agency, there was only a small sample size from 77 to 80. What was clearly happening was more teams were able to compete because they had open access to quality players. So even though the Yankees ended up signing Dave Winfield for 81, the Indians, who were pretty down in the dumps and a lowly franchise, were neck and neck with the Yankees to sign Winfield. The increased competitive balance, which led to increased talk about baseball year-round, as fans and newspapers talked about the new free agents, led to more attendance, increased popularity, and led to a decade in the 80s where more teams made the World Series than I think in any decade ever. Had the owners had their way, we would have gone backwards to a time where only the top teams were always in contention. So I think the players, by standing up for a principle they really believed in, which was free agency, they ended up creating a game that had more appeal and more balance than ever before.
You talk about some of the sub-stories in the 1981 season, like Fernando Mania and the Bronx Zoo. Let's go into it a little bit. Talk to me a little bit about Fernando Mania, because he was a rookie. He came in and he just dominated, but he also caught everybody's attention.
Yes, some might recall that at the end of 1980, Fernando was brought up for the month of September, pitched scoreless ball for the whole month, and the Dodgers played the Astros in a one-game playoff to make the championship series. Fernando was under consideration to start. He didn't. The Dodgers started Dave Golds and got slaughtered. So going into the 81 season, Fernando was somewhat known. Particularly in L.A., he even made the cover of the media guide. But the idea was he was a quality rookie who would maybe be the number three or four starter. Through a series of injuries to the top starters like Jerry Royce and Bert Hooton and Don Sutton had moved to the Astros as a free agent, Fernando started opening day in L.A., and he shut out the Astros. That set off a first half of the season that was incomparable. He was 8-0, he threw 8-1. He threw five shutouts in his first seven starts, and the build of national attention for him was phenomenal. And I think part of that was there was a real purity and innocence to him, as well as incredible talent, that really was a contrast to the miserable daily stories of the failed negotiations that eventually led to the strike.
Most people don't know what led up to him coming into the major leagues, because he wasn't somebody that was on a radar screen or you read much stories about. Did he just come out of nowhere, Jeff?
There's a couple of interesting bits to that. You know, when the Dodgers were in Brooklyn, they always looked for a Jewish player because there was a big Jewish population in New York. When the Dodgers moved to L.A., there was a lot of controversy about building Dodger Stadium at Chavez Ravine. There had been a Latino community there that was uprooted. So the Dodgers had a very tense to non-existent relationship with the Latino community, which was growing and growing and growing. The Dodgers always kind of, in a sense, were looking for a Mexican Sandy Koufax. But the way they found Fernando was by a fluke. Mike Brito, who was one of their main scouts, went down to Sonora, I believe, to see a shortstop. He ended up seeing Fernando, who he signed as a pitcher, but it was in, I believe, San Antonio in AA that Fernando learned his forkball from Bobby Castillo, who was another Dodger pitcher. He immediately mastered it. He became something of a phenom in the minors, came up in September 1980, And like I say, in 81, they had high hopes for him, but nothing compared to the explosion that resulted in Fernando Mania.
Was there ever any question about his age? Because I think, you know, over the years in baseball, when you had some Caribbean players or South American players, you always wondered whether they were the age they stated.
Yeah. You know, he was always reported as 20 that year. He had, you know, an old face. He had, like, kind of an old Aztec god-looking face, you know? I mean, he didn't look like a young kid. It's funny now because I think his face hasn't changed that much over time. You realize how young he was. It's obvious he's a kid. He's not, you know, 28 years old. But that was a rumor at the time. Part of it also was there was somewhat of an unbelievable nature to his whole rise. Not only was he 20, but looked older, but his motion was quirky. If you recall, you know, he kind of looked to the heavens mid-motion. There was something unique about him that made him hard to really pigeonhole, which is why I think everyone loved him. He was so different.
Everybody certainly remembers the battle that went on between Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa and Barry Bonds as well, trying to break Hank Aaron's career home run mark and season mark as well. What was it like with Pete Rose chasing the National League record for career hits?
In 1981, Rose was on pace to break Sam Musial's all-time National League record. And one of the things that was really nice about researching the book, and believe me, as mayor of Cooperstown, Pete Rose has always kind of been my discussion point. People always want to know how I feel about Pete and his Hall of Fame case. But in 1981, to look at him, to watch him, to study him, just as Pete Rose, before the controversy, there was no one who had more joy on the field, who brought more joy to the fans than Pete Rose. And to recapture that was wonderful. And Rose tied Musial's record. He got a single against Nolan Ryan a day before the strike hit. Strike comes. He's locked in with Musial. And then on the first complete day of the new second half of the season on August 10th, he got a single to break the record. And everyone was overjoyed. He got a call from Ronald Reagan, who was the then new president. Everybody loved Pete Rose. It's hard to remember the time where everybody loved Pete Rose.
Well, I'm sure my listeners would be upset if I didn't follow up the door that you opened. Where do you stand on Pete Rose?
You know, I'm a kind of big haul kind of guy. I have no problems with the PED guys, none. I wear a Barry Bonds button on my coat in Cooperstown, and just by fluke, my Cooperstown kind of vanity license plate is number 762, which is just a great irony. But the gambling is different. Everybody knew gambling was forbidden in baseball. Every clubhouse has it posted. Gambling more than PEDs truly strikes at the integrity of the game. So, you know, Pete betting on the Reds and maybe or maybe not betting against the Reds, but in his absence of betting on them was kind of an implication and a signal that they were going to lose. There's bigger problems with gambling than with PEDs, to me. That being said, you know, the Hall decided after MLB decided to ban him for life that players banned for life are not eligible. Conceivably, the Hall could have not made that call, and it's not for me to kind of criticize or question. It's their business, and it's long before I was here. But the one thing that Costi Kennedy brings up in his Pete Rose book and in columns after is Pete's the only one who has never had the luxury of a vote. He's never let the writers have never been able to decide like they have on Clemens and Bonds and McGwire and those guys. If Pete got in, it would not be a problem for me. If Pete never gets in, it's not a problem for me anyway. I mean, people who have been to the Hall know what a great special place it is. Is it perfect? No, but what is? So I have more ambivalence about Rose, which is kind of odd because no one seems to be unemotional about Pete Rose.
We're talking with the author, Jeff Katz. Check out his book. It's called Split Season 1981. Being a New Yorker as you are, I think you know as well as I do, probably the franchise that has provided the most drama and the most interest is going to be the New York Yankees. And in your book, you talk about the clubhouse atmosphere with George Steinbrenner and his two superstars, Reggie Jackson and Dave Winfield. And then you have to throw this element into the whole mix, and that's Billy Martin.
Exactly. So by 81, so Dave Winfield is brought in as the big marquee free agent. George kind of uses Reggie Jackson a little bit as a sounding board to see if Reggie thought Winfield was worth signing. Reggie thought yes for multiple reasons, good for the team, but also good for Reggie, which is a motivating factor, because Reggie was going to be a free agent for the second time in 81. What people forget about Steinbrenner, certainly someone of my age, I'm going to be 53. If you grew up in New York or followed baseball in that period, you knew George Steinbrenner was kind of like an insane sadist. Nowadays, you know, in the late 90s when the Yankees started winning and winning and Steinbrenner became kind of a comic figure on Seinfeld, he became a little bit lovable. That is not what he was in 1981. So for the whole year, Steinbrenner encouraged Winfield, really ridiculed Jackson in the press. Jackson is, you know, is known for some kind of a fragile psyche. His first half was a disaster. He was hitting below 200. He ended up rebounding and then leaving and going to the Angels. So the psychodrama of the Yankees that year is interesting. Meanwhile, Billy Martin, who had been fired again from the Yankees after 1979 for punching a marshmallow salesman at a bar, is in Oakland for his second year. The A's get off to an incredible start, a record-breaking start from opening day on. And Billy's feeling pretty confident and pretty cocky that he's got the best team. He certainly had the best player in the league. Rickey Henderson was only in his, I think, second full year, but it was clear that Rickey was the man. So Billy's riding high. He ends up meeting his old team, his old friends and foes, the Yankees, in the championship series, and they get slaughtered. So the fact that Billy ended up facing the Yankees is another interesting subplot of the story.
We only have 2 minutes left, Jeff, but there was one other aspect as well that has never happened again in baseball, because when play did resume, it was done so in a split-season type of format. I remember it, and it was kind of weird.
It was weird, and it was another kind of owner, you know, misstep. The strike got settled. The player said to the owners, you figure out how you want to resume the season. And there were a lot of various plans presented at owners' meetings on how to continue. An easy plan would have been just continue the season. There was some sense from the owners that, and certainly Bowie Kuhn was in favor, of starting afresh. It might help create new pennant races. It might help the teams that were out of it in the first half gain some interest. You know, there's no reason to think someone would come to a Mariners game after their first half, you know, terrible performance. Plus, there was something in the national TV contract that allowed the owners to put in another level of playoffs. It was a disaster because pennant races take time to develop. And actually, had the season resumed in full, there still would have been great pennant races at the end of the year. The top five teams in the AL East were about two games apart, I think. So if you would have had true, credible pennant races, instead you had this kind of makeshift, split seasons, first level of playoffs that no one was that interested in. The ratings were terrible. And actually, in retrospect, it may have delayed that new round of playoffs till the mid-90s rather than have it earlier. So, as you say, it was an odd year on so many levels.
In about 30 seconds, what do you want people to take away from this book?
What I'd like people to take away is a real understanding of what the players fought for. People who kind of say, you know, the state of baseball labor relations is that the players are greedy, period. It's too easy, too simple, and really fundamentally not true. What Marvin Miller did with the union and with the players as intelligent people who wanted to improve their work conditions was an amazing story of real principle and cause. And the idea that all the game's ills are because of the players is kind of nonsense. And I think people need to read up to see that.
Jeff, I want to thank you very much. Congratulations on this book. It's a wonderful read, and I hope people will check it out. Come back with us anytime here on Sports Byline.
Love to, Ron. Thank you.
Jeff Katz with us, the author of the book Split Season 1981, Fernando Mania, The Bronx Zoo, and The Strike That Saved Baseball. We continue with more of you and America's sports talk show.